No railroad was mentioned by name in the speeches that preceded the voting. The speeches dealt only with the public welfare. It was said that, while the public welfare was threatened by shortages of transportation, railroads were destroying one another through vicious competition on the brutal policy of dog-eat-dog. While there existed blighted areas where rail service had been discontinued, there existed at the same time large regions where two or more railroads were competing for a traffic barely sufficient for one. It was said that there were great opportunities for younger railroads in the blighted areas. While it was true that such areas offered little economic incentive at present, a public-spirited railroad, it was said, would undertake to provide transportation for the struggling inhabitants, since the prime purpose of a railroad was public service, not profit. Then it was said that large established railroad systems were essential to the public welfare, and that the collapse of one of them would be a national catastrophe, and that if one such system had happened to sustain a crushing loss in a public-spirited attempt to contribute to international goodwill, it was entitled to public support to help it survive the blow. No railroad was mentioned by name, but when the chairman of the meeting raised his hand, as a solemn signal that they were about to vote, everybody looked at Dan Conway, president of the Phoenix Durango. There were only 5 dissenters who voted against it. Yet when the chairman announced that the measure had passed, there was no cheering, no sounds of approval, no movement, nothing but a heavy silence. To the last minute, every one of them had hoped that someone would save them from it. The anti-dog-eat-dog rule was described as a measure of voluntary self-regulation, intended the better to enforce the laws long since passed by the country's legislature. The rule provided that the members of the National Alliance of Railroads were forbidden to engage in practices defined as destructive competition, that in regions declared to be restricted, no more than one railroad would be permitted to operate, that in such regions, seniority belonged to the oldest railroad now operating there, and that the newcomers who had encroached unfairly upon its territory would suspend operations within 9 months after being so ordered, that the Executive Board of the National Alliance of Railroads was empowered to decide, at its sole discretion, which regions were to be restricted. When the meeting adjourned, the men hastened to leave. There were no private discussions, no friendly loitering. The Great Hall became deserted in an unusually short time. Nobody spoke to or looked at Dan Conway. In the lobby of the building, James Taggart met Orrin Boyle. They had made no appointment to meet, but Taggart saw a bulky figure outlined against a marble wall and knew who it was before he saw the face. They approached each other, and Boyle said, his smile less soothing than usual, "I've delivered. Your turn now, Jimmy." "You didn't have to come here. Why did you?" said Taggart sullenly. "Oh, just for the fun of it," said Boyle. Dan Conway sat alone among rows of empty seats. He was still there when the charwoman came to clean the hall. When she hailed him, he rose obediently and shuffled to the door. Passing her in the aisle, he fumbled in his pocket and handed her a $5 bill silently, meekly, not looking at her face. He did not seem to know what he was doing. He acted as if he thought that he was in some place where generosity demanded that he give a tip before leaving. Dagny was still at her desk when the door of her office flew open and James Taggart rushed in. It was the first time he had ever entered in such manner. His face looked feverish. She had not seen him since the nationalization of the San Sebastian line. He had not sought to discuss it with her, and she had said nothing about it. She had been proved right so eloquently, she had thought, that comments were unnecessary. A feeling which was part courtesy, part mercy, had stopped her from stating to him the conclusion to be drawn from the events. In all reason and justice, there was but one conclusion he could draw. She had heard about his speech to the board of directors. She had shrugged, contemptuously amused. If it served his purpose, whatever that was, to appropriate her achievements, then for his own advantage, if for no other reason, he would leave her free to achieve from now on. "So you think you're the only one who's doing anything for this railroad?" She looked at him bewildered. His voice was shrill. He stood in front of her desk, tense with excitement. "So you think that I've ruined the company, don't you?" he yelled. "And now you're the only one who can save us? Think I have no way to make up for the Mexican laws?" She asked slowly, "What do you want?" "I want to tell you some news. Do you remember the anti-dog-eat-dog proposal of the railroad alliance that I told you about months ago? You didn't like the idea. You didn't like it at all."
"I remember."
"What about it?"
"It has been passed."
"What has been passed?"
"The anti-dog-eat-dog rule, just a few minutes ago. At the meeting. 9 months from now, there's not going to be any Phoenix-Durango Railroad in Colorado."
A glass ashtray crashed to the floor off the desk as she leaped to her feet.
"You rotten bastards!"
He stood motionless. He was smiling. She knew that she was shaking, open to him, without defense, and that this was the sight he enjoyed, but it did not matter to her. Then she saw his smile, and suddenly the blinding anger vanished. She felt nothing. She studied that smile with a cold, impersonal curiosity. They stood facing each other. He looked as if, for the first time, he was not afraid of her. He was gloating. The event meant something to him much beyond the destruction of a competitor. It was not a victory over Dan Conway, but over her. She did not know why or in what manner, but she felt certain that he knew. For the flash of one instant, she thought that here, before her, in James Taggart, and in that which made him smile, was a secret she had never suspected, and it was crucially important that she learn to understand it. But the thought flashed and vanished. She whirled to the door of a closet and seized her coat.
"Where are you going?"
Taggart's voice had dropped. It sounded disappointed and faintly worried. She did not answer. She rushed out of the office.
"Dan, you have to fight them. I'll help you. I'll fight for you with everything I've got."
Dan Conway shook his head. He sat at his desk, the empty expanse of a faded blotter before him, one feeble lamp lighted in a corner of the room. Dagny had rushed straight to the city office of the Phoenix Durango. Conway was there, and he still sat as she had found him. He had smiled at her entrance and said,
"Funny, I thought you would come."
His voice gentle, lifeless. They did not know each other well, but they had met a few times in Colorado.
"No," he said, "it's no use."
"Do you mean because of that alliance agreement that you signed? It won't hold. This is plain expropriation. No court will uphold it. And if Jim tries to hide behind the usual looter's slogan of public welfare, I'll go on the stand and swear that Taggart Transcontinental can't handle the whole traffic of Colorado. And if any court rules against you, you can appeal and keep on appealing for the next 10 years.
"Yes," he said, "I could. I'm not sure I'd win, but I could try, and I could hang on to the railroad for a few years longer, but no, it's not the legal points that I'm thinking about, one way or the other. It's not that."
"What then?"
"I don't want to fight it, Dagny."
She looked at him incredulously. It was the one sentence which she felt sure he had never uttered before. A man could not reverse himself so late in life. Dan Conway was approaching 50. He had the square, stolid, stubborn face of a tough freight engineer rather than a company president, the face of a fighter, with a young, tanned skin and graying hair. He had taken over a shaky little railroad in Arizona, a road whose net revenue was less than that of a successful grocery store, and he had built it into the best railroad of the Southwest. He spoke little, seldom read books, had never gone to college. The whole sphere of human endeavors, with one exception, left him blankly indifferent. He had no touch of that which people called culture, but he knew railroads.
"Why don't you want to fight?"
"Because they had the right to do it."
"Dan," she asked, "have you lost your mind?"
"I've never gone back on my word in my life," he said tonelessly. "I don't care what the courts decide. I promise to obey the majority. I have to obey."
Did you expect the majority to do this to you?
No.